had a nice weekend. Maybe saw some fireworks. I actually don't really like fireworks. I don't know why. Ever since I was a kid, and I thought pretty lights in the sky. You know, not really my thing. My dogs absolutely hate it, and so they were in the house for most of the evening, which is okay. Anyhow, so a quick note about this week's quiz, which will cover both formation of still being and the stereo chemistry experiment. The quiz is a little long, okay? So when I wrote the questions and everything, I went over it, and I said, oh, this is going to probably take a little bit longer than the normal quiz. That's why everybody has 15 minutes on it instead of the normal 10. Okay, and at the top of the quiz, it says 15 minutes. All right? You don't have to take the full 15 minutes, but if you need a little bit of extra time, you will have it. Okay? All right, so in this week's experiments, we're going to be doing a nucleophilic substitution reaction. Specifically, we are going to be converting 2-methyl to butanol to the corresponding 2-chloral 2-methylbutane. So we're replacing the alcohol functional group with the chlorine functional group. All right, so this is a classic nucleophilic substitution. And to do a nucleophilic substitution, you need, of course, two things. You need one, you need a nucleophile. And in our case, the nucleophile is going to be the chloride ion. And the other thing that you need is a leaving group, all right? So let's address the nucleophile first. If we need the chloride ion as our nucleophile, what's our source gonna be? Well, a really, really inexpensive source would be sodium chloride. And that does give us the chloride ion. However, if you take 2-chloral, or if you take sodium chloride and add it to the alcohol, you are not going to get the nucleophilic substitution reaction to occur. And the reason for that is because of the second thing you need, which is a leaving group. And alcohols are notoriously bad leaving groups. Doesn't mean they can't be. There are reactions where they do act as leaving groups. But if an alcohol leaves, you get, of course, the hydroxide ion. This is a terrible leaving group and certainly would not work if we simply used sodium chloride. And that is why our reaction uses hydrochloric acid instead. So by using hydrochloric acid, the first step in the mechanism is we protonate the alcohol. Now our leaving group is not the hydroxide ion, it is instead a water molecule. And so once we protonate the alcohol, we then have the water leaving. This is a tertiary carbon, so remember it's going to undergo the SN1 mechanism. And so now we've created the carbocation, and now our chloride ion can come in and attack the carbocation, and we get our final product, 2-chloral-2-methylbutane. Okay? So it's a straightforward nucleophilic substitution reaction, and as far as doing the reaction, this is one of those kind of win-win for everybody. To do the reaction, we're going to be doing it on our separatory funnel. We're going to add hydrochloric acid and the alcohol, and then you simply shake it for 5 minutes, and then the reaction is over. Okay? It's a very easy reaction to do. And then, of course, you are going to do some product workup. And there is something that you will see in the instructions. And that is a kind of a new word. And that is going to be wash. Okay? So you'll see something like wash your organic layer with saturated sodium chloride. And all a wash is a liquid-liquid extraction. Okay? But we use the terminology to differentiate what we're actually doing. When you do a liquid-liquid extraction, so if you see the term extract the organic layer with diethyl or with aqueous hydrochloric acid or something like that. In that case, you're removing something from the organic layer into the extraction solvent that you want. So you're extracting something out that you want. When you're doing a wash, you're removing stuff from your original solvent that you don't want. So in other words, you're washing it or you're cleaning it. You're removing material that you don't want in your final product.
Okay, so it's just a word, a terminology that you need to understand because it will help you figuring out, well, where's my product? Which layer is it in? If you're extracting, it's going into the extraction solvent. If you're washing, it is staying in the original solvent, okay? So it is important to understand the difference between those two terms because it does help you if you get a little bit confused. Which one of these has my product in it? Well, what were you doing, washing or extracting? Okay. As I said, however, not that difficult a reaction to do. Cleanup, fairly straightforward. We do need, of course, to focus on the hydrochloric acid for just a little bit. We're going to be using concentrated hydrochloric acid. This is, of course, a very, very strong, powerful acid. And we're using 12.5 milliliters. So it is a significant amount of hydrochloric acid. We do not want to get exposed to this. All right? So whenever you're handling chemicals that are serious, that's how I'll put it. This is something that can actually cause serious harm if an accident occurs. You need to be careful. It doesn't mean, you know, you stiffen up and you take little baby steps or whatever to get from one area to the other. It just means that you need to be more cautious. It's like when you're merging onto I-35. Alright? One of the most terrifying moments of anybody's life is merging into traffic that is going very quickly. Okay? Rush hour traffic, I never worry about merging. This is like worst thing that's gonna happen is a finger bender. But so when you're merging, you usually have both hands on the steering wheel, you're checking mirrors, you're doing all that stuff. But once you get into the traffic, you relax just a little bit. Okay? It's the same basic idea here. We're using a chemical that we have to pay extra attention to. And that means a couple of things. It means when you are transporting it from the chemical hood to your area, you need to be relaxed in the way you carry it. Don't carry it stiff on. Okay? Carry it in a comfortable manner. Because whenever you're stiff and locked, and you make and you bump something, you're going to have a much larger chance of spilling it. Okay? You also need to kind of monitor your surroundings. If your hood's over there, and there are a whole bunch of people congregating right here, walk around it. Okay, they take a few extra steps, but you don't want to bump into anybody when you're carrying this chemical. Conversely, those of you in the lab need to understand, hey, there are people walking around this lab that might have 12.5 milliliters of concentrated hydrochloric acid in the beaker they're carrying. Look before you turn. And when you make moves, don't elbows up, we're not boxing out, we're not trying to go up for a rebound or anything like that. We're making a turn, so you kind of want to watch out where you are. In other words, everybody needs to be aware of their surroundings because we all know what we're working with this group, okay? Another thing, you don't want to have this hydrochloric acid in the atmosphere for or carrying it from the hood to your work area for very long because I don't know if you've ever had the experience of breathing in hydrochloric acid, it's not pleasant. It cleans out your sinuses, all right? Whatever you were smelling, you can't smell for a while. You simply smell concentrated hydrochloric acid, all right? So we don't want to be out holding this beaker outside of the hood for any extended period of time, just long enough to get from one area to the other, all right? And also remember, don't crowd people by the hood. I've seen when you're there getting chemicals and everything, and that's somewhat of a pain. You know, everybody kind of has to wait in line. Give people a little space, all right? Okay,
if you do accidentally get exposed to concentrated hydrochloric acid, because of the equipment and everything that we wear, the most common spills that we have now is unfortunately on our face, all right?
So if that happens, then you're going to the eyewash station or the sink as quickly as you possibly can. The thing about strong acids is once they make contact with your skin, they're starting to do damage. And the idea is you want to get it washed off as quickly as you possibly can. The longer it's on, the more damage it's going to cause, okay? And there's only one kind of good thing, and I don't want to call it good, but there's only one positive aspect of getting concentrated acid on your skin, and that's that you have absolutely no doubt that that is what you have just been exposed to. Okay, you get concentrated hydrochloric acid, concentrated sulfuric acid, anything like that on your skin, you're going to know about it immediately. And so get it under the water and rinse for 15 minutes. Okay? I will point out one thing is that if it was on there for any extended period of time, and I want to say longer than at least a minute, before you noticed it, you're going to be rinsing it for 15 minutes with cold water. And it might numb the area a little bit. And as soon as you stop rinsing it, you might start feeling a little bit more pain again. Okay? It's not because it's still on there, it's because that damage has already been done. Okay? It's usually a mild sunburn if it's on there for about a minute or so. Anything longer than that, it can be a little bit more serious, all right? We do have, of course, all of the first aid equipment in the labs, and if this does happen, we will make sure that you've rinsed thoroughly for 15 minutes, and then we'll have a conversation with you. I had an accident in the spring, where a student got a little bit of sulfuric acid on her forehead, rinsed it for 15 minutes, didn't feel comfortable anymore in the lab, understandable, and so, all right, just go home, and we'll deal with this afterwards. And literally, a day or two later, the student said, it's completely gone, okay? So, again, the key factor is getting it underwater as quickly as you possibly can.
Also inspect your gloves. If you think, hey, that might be sulfuric acid or that might be hydrochloric acid, you take them off, dispose of them, put new ones on. Okay? All right. So after we work with the crude product to obtain our final product, 2-chlorotoluene is a liquid. And so we aren't going to be taking a melting point, obviously, as an identification step. Theoretically, we could do a boiling point. It is the exact same concept.
We take the boiling point of our product. If it matches the known boiling point, you know, that's a good indication. However, boiling points are actually much harder to do and much more prone to error. So we're not going to be doing the boiling point as a method of identification. We, of course, are still going to determine a percent yield because all we have to do is weigh the product.
Do not weigh 2-chlorotoluene in those little plastic weigh boats because it dissolves those little plastic weigh boats. Use your very small beaker, tear that out, add your liquid to the beaker, then you get your mass for your product, okay? For product analysis, we are going to be doing a modern analysis, which is infrared spectroscopy, and a more old-fashioned approach, which we call the halide test. So let's talk about the halide test first. So before modern instrumentation became ubiquitous in teaching labs and so forth, and this started happening somewhere around the late 1970s, early 1980s. That's when instruments started to come down in price so that you could start having them in teaching labs. If you made something, how did you prove you'd made it? You know? Well, one of the things that you can do is a wet chemical test to determine if a functional group is present. So for every functional group, a test has been developed that will tell you yes or no. Yes or no. Is this functional group present? So one of the ones you can test for, of course, are the halogens, and that's what we're going to be doing here. There are two of them that we're going to do. We're going to do the sodium iodide test and the silver nitrate test. Both of these work very similarly. Sodium iodide will react with your halide to produce the sodium halide, which is a solid. It'll precipitate out of solution, and the iodide. And so the positive test is, of course, the formation of a precipitate in this test. Silver nitrate, again, in essence, the same basic thing happens where we form the silver halide, which forms of a precipitate and the nitrate. Okay. So both of these tests, if a precipitate forms, that tells you yes or no in terms of whether or not a halogen is present. If you had absolutely no clue what the halogen was, you would then isolate the solid and do a further test on it. You can actually determine it. We are not going to be doing those. We're just going to kind of make the leap of faith that precipitate forms means that the chloride is present in our product. But these two tests give us more information than just yes or no. They also tell us something about the structure of the molecule. And it does that because the sodium iodide test undergoes the SN1 mechanism. Oops. Sorry. At least I caught it this time. Undergoes the SN2 mechanism, where silver nitrate undergoes the SN1 mechanism. So because these two tests use different mechanisms, all we need to do is look at the rate of the formation of the precipitate. Because the SN2 prefers primary over secondary over tertiary, and SN1 is the exact opposite. Since we're making a tertiary chloride, what we want to see in our results is that when you do the silver nitrate test, the precipitate forms almost instantaneously. The sodium iodide test may not even form a precipitate. We're only going to let it go for about 5 minutes or so. And within that time frame, it may not actually have time to form a precipitate. Okay? So that's the result we want to see. Silver nitrate, very, very fast. Sodium iodide, much, much slower, if no precipitate at all, within that 5 minute time frame. Okay, so both of these tests will give us solid evidence that we have indeed made 2-chloro-2-methylbutane. Okay, so the other method that we're going to be using is the modern approach, which is infrared spectroscopy. And infrared spectroscopy is a very, very powerful instrument because it can tell you a lot about the structure of your molecule in terms of what functional groups are present and so forth. And we all think about, okay, we draw this carbon-carbon single bond or carbon-oxygen in an alcohol or a carbonyl or a carbon-hydrogen. When we draw these, it's a really good, just simple representation of that's a carbon-carbon single bond, okay? But it doesn't actually represent what a real carbon-carbon single bond actually is. If you think about the bond in three-dimensional space, the best way to think about bonds are two balls held together by a spring. And they have motion relative to each other. They can stretch apart, they can compress, they can bend, so forth. So they have all kinds of motion relative to each other. Motion, of course, requires energy, and it just so happens that the energy required to get atoms to bend, stretch, etc., falls within the infrared spectrum. Okay, so for the previous 2 weeks, we've been talking about breaking bonds using either the visible spectrum with some sort of initiation with our bromine. Or in this case, we're not breaking the bonds, we're just getting them to move. And because a carbon-carbon single bond requires different amounts of energy than does a carbon-oxygen in an alcohol versus a carbonyl versus a carbon-hydrogen stretch, all we have to do is look at the absorbance patterns. We shine an infrared spectrum on a molecule and then look, oh, what wavelengths were absorbed. We can then identify what type of functional groups, what type of bonds are present in our molecule. And this is a very, very, very kind of distilled, simplistic explanation of infrared spectroscopy. There's a lot of other stuff that goes into it. There's a lot of math and so forth. And so if you kind of are interested in this area, I recommend taking a spectroscopy class because they will give you all of that, you know, nerdy stuff about why does this bond bend that way or whatever, all right? I'm just talking about how are we going to use this instrument to tell us have we made the correct product or not. And the way we use it is, first we break the infrared spectrum into two halves. So the first half is what we call the functional group region. And this occurs from about 4,000 inverse centimeters to approximately 1,250 inverse centimeters. Most of your functional groups will absorb within this range. And there are tables with this information, and I'm of course not going to ask you to memorize any of this. There are three, however, that you should know. Okay. The first is the carbon-hydrogen stretch. The carbon-hydrogen stretch occurs between about 3,000 to 2,850 inverse centimeters and is typically a strong absorbance. All right. It does depend a little bit about the functional group, which I'll talk in just a minute. But usually the carbon-hydrogen stretch is a very strong absorbance, okay? The next one is going to be the carbonyl peak. And again, that is a very, very strong absorbance. It's from about 1650 to 1750 inverse centimeters, and depending if it's a ketone, an aldehyde, carboxylic acid, whatever carbonyl peak you have, depending on your overall functional group, will tell you specifically where that absorbance is going to be. And then the last one is the alcohol functional group. Again, this is a peak that will vary. Unlike the carbonyl peak, which is always a very strong absorbance, the alcohol peak can go from very, very, very small to very, very, very strong. It can go from skinny to very broad. Okay? And the reason for this has to do with hydrogen bonding.
So if we think about the molecule that has probably the most hydrogen bonding in it, there is, that is water. You put water in an IR, you're going to basically get one very, very large OH peak. And that's because there's a lot of hydrogen bonding between the individual molecules within the solution. So if we have liquid alcohols that have relatively short carbon chains on them, ethanol, methanol, etc., we are also going to have a very strong, broad OH peak. If we have alcohols that have very large organic components to them, then that intensity is going to start to diminish, and it's going to start to get narrower. When you get to solid alcohols, you still have those peaks, but they're very, very small and very thin. Okay? So one of the things that you have to understand about looking at your product is you say, hey, I'm going to look at the functional group region of my IR. Is it consistent with my product? Okay? So, in this example I have here, ethanol. Ethanol has two of those functional groups. It has the carbon-hydrogen stretch, and it has the alcohol functional group. Ethanol is a liquid. It's a short carbon chain. So we expect to see a very large, broad OH peak, and that is exactly what we see from about 3,200 to roughly 3,600 inverse centimeters, okay? So this alcohol peak is consistent with what we would expect to see with ethanol. Here's an alcohol peak with a tetradecanol, okay, that's 14 carbons, all right? So the alcohol peak is still there, much skinnier, much weaker, okay? So again, when you're looking at the molecule, do you have the functional group that are you expecting to see, and does it fit in terms of the intensity and the strength, et cetera, okay? It also has the carbon-hydrogen stretch. And in both ethanol and tetradecanol, we see the carbon-hydrogen stretch here, 3,000 inverse centimeters, and again, very, very strong. And I apologize, these are actually reversed because I'm also going to talk about the intensity of the carbon-hydrogen stretch, but I got to go back one. Okay, so if we look at ethyl benzene, okay, ethyl benzene has two functional groups that have the carbon-hydrogen stretch. It has the aromatic and it has the aliphatic. Aliphatics are very strong. So ethyl benzene, we get this nice strong carbon-hydrogen stretch absorbance. We also have some aromatic carbon-hydrogen stretches, but aromatics are much weaker and they're actually buried within here. We also are looking at diphenyl ether. So in this case, all we have is the aromatics. And as you can see, the carbon-hydrogen stretch is here, but it's much, much weaker. Okay? So again, another example of, do I expect this function to work? Yes or no? What kind of intensity am I thinking about? Is it going to be a strong intensity? Is it going to be weak? Okay?
Now, why do aromatics have this much, much smaller absorbance versus aliphatics? Well, that boils down to a thing called symmetry. When you're thinking about a carbon-hydrogen stretch, the carbon atom is here, the hydrogen atom is here, and they're stretching apart. The two atoms have very different molecular weights, so it is going to be relatively simple to see that particular stretch. Unless you have something moving in exactly the opposite direction. Okay? So for instance, this carbon-hydrogen stretch and this carbon-hydrogen stretch are 180 degrees going in opposite directions. You can't see that. They cancel each other out, okay? So that's why we see this aromatic hydrogens having much, much smaller absorbances, is because there's usually some symmetry involved with them and they cancel each other out. Again, there are explanations for this. I'm not gonna go into it. But again, if you are kind of, oh, this sounds interesting, then I highly recommend, again, taking a spectroscopy class, because they'll tell you all the mathematics and everything that goes into why this actually happens, okay? We're not focused on that. Again, we're just focused on how do we use this spectrum to see if it proves our product or not, okay? All right, so we look at the functional group region. We are making 2-chloro-2-methyl-butane. We should expect to see a carbon-hydrogen stretch because they're aliphatic hydrogens. We expect them to be very, very strong. We are going from an alcohol to a chloride. So in our product, we expect to see no OH peak. All right, so that's another kind of level to this is, are there peaks present that shouldn't be there? Okay? So if I have an alcohol peak, I need to explain it. And it's very easy to explain extra peaks. Maybe your sample is still wet, something went wrong, or whatever. It's contaminated with impurities. Peaks that are supposed to be present that are absent, much harder to explain. There are valid reasons for it, but usually we want to just not have that occur, okay? I expect to see an OH peak. It should be pretty big and pretty broad. That's what I have, okay? So with our functional group region, we are looking for the carbon-hydrogen stretch and in a strong, intense absorbance around 3,000 inverse centimeters. We expect to see no OH peak, and so we're not going to see this big OH peak at all in our product. We do have one other functional group, and that of course is the carbon chlorine functional group. Unfortunately, halogens absorb outside of the normal functional group regions. Carbon chlorine absorbs somewhere around 700 inverse centimeters. And you might be thinking, well, why don't we just go on down to that area of the spectrum and see if that peak is present. The problem with that has to do with our specific IRs, okay? That region is kind of called the far IR region. It's just on the very end. And when we moved into NHP in 2010, we purchased 7 brand new IRs. And we got them at a very good educational discount at about $35,000 a piece. If we wanted to see the absorbance between 800 and 400 inverse centimeters, we would need to cough up an additional 30 grand. Okay? That's a lot of money for a very narrow bandwidth. We have decided to instead save that money, get a second IR, and simply use the halide test. Much cheaper, gives us the same result. All right? So
The reason why we don't see it has to do with resolution. We just simply don't have good resolution in there. Sometimes students get really good peaks there. Whether or not they actually are the carbon-chlorine bond, unfortunately, we can't 100% say. Because again, the resolution just isn't that good. Okay, so that's the functional group. So you take your IR, you look at the functional group region. Is it consistent with my molecule? I don't want to see an OH peak. I want to see a carbon-hydrogen stretch, and I want it to be strong. The second half is what we call the fingerprint region. And this is from about 1250 inverse centimeters to, again, approximately 400 inverse centimeters. We actually only go down to about 800. The fingerprint region is basically what I like to call the carbon skeleton, the three-dimensional structure of your molecule. How that structure is affecting this carbon-carbon stretch, because this has a tertiary carbon versus a single carbon bond over here, and all of that put together. No two separate molecules have identical fingerprint regions, okay? So if it is a different molecule, it will have a different fingerprint region. That's kind of where the name comes from, because in other words, each individual molecule has a very unique fingerprint region. And the two examples I have down here are 2-methylbutane and 2,3-dimethylbutane, very, very similar in terms of their structure. Butane is 4, and then the 2-methane is right there, and then 2,3-dimethylbutane is this. Okay? Not very different. And if we look at the IR spectrum, they have that carbon-hydrogen stretch. Functional group regions are almost identical. And it's the fingerprint region where we see the differences. Now, it's kind of hard to tell when you're looking at them, you know, not overlaid. So when you actually overlay them, this is where you see those differences pop up. Okay? So when we take the IR of our product, we will then compare our fingerprint region to the fingerprint region of a known IR spectra of 2,4-methylbutane. And if they're the same, no two molecules can have an identical fingerprint region. So if they're the same, they are the same molecule. Okay? So when you take the IR of our product, we're going to analyze the functional group region. Is it consistent with my product, yes or no? Then we look at the fingerprint region. Is it consistent with my molecule, yes or no? If they line up, hey, this is really good solid evidence that this IR is an IR of 2,4-methylbutane. And as I said, you can have extra peaks, and oftentimes you will see them in the fingerprint region. But they can occur in the functional group region. The biggest one that we see in functional group regions with our lab is an OH peak, because typically we're going from an aqueous solution to a non-aqueous solution, and if there's a little bit of water still around, we'll get a big OH peak or something like that. But if we have extra peaks in the fingerprint region and they're not very big, you just chalk that up to impurities are present. That's very straightforward. Missing peaks, that's what we don't ever want to see. If there was no carbon-hydrogen stretch here, that's a bad sign, okay? There are legitimate explanations for it, but you just don't want to get in there, you know? You're starting to twist yourself into knots with explanations, and usually it's best to just take another IR. Okay,
So, since I mentioned how expensive the IRs were back in 2010, the average lifespan of an IR in a teaching lab is roughly 15 years. That was 16 years ago. And the IRs started to die. Okay? And so starting about 3 years ago, we started replacing them. We have four new IRs. They are in the north end of the hallway. And we still have three of the old IRs working. And they are in the south end. That threw me off for a bit, I'm sorry. It's okay. We want to keep these IRs running as long as we possibly can. So to that end, we have some fairly straightforward rules that we want you to follow. Rule number one is clean area. So the area around the instrument, you're gonna bring your sample in a beaker or whatever, whatever you bring with you, leaves with you. You don't want any abandoned beakers or test tubes or anything sitting there having no idea what's in it. Okay? That's not too hard to follow, but please remember to keep the area around the IRs clean. The second rule is to keep the IR clean. And you clean the IR before you use it. It's fairly straightforward. You take some isopropyl alcohol and spray it across the flat surface, and you wipe that with a Kim wipe, and then you take a cotton swab and wipe a little armature to clean off any residue that is building up, okay? So you clean the IR before you use it. And if you're the last one to use it, you have to clean it after you've used it, okay? Number three, this is the very, very, very hard rule for you guys. Patience. Especially with the three older IRs.
Those IRs, when we purchased them, interfaced with Windows XP in 2010. We've upgraded our computers since then. We have new software since then. They still interface at the speed of Windows XP. And so that means they take a little bit longer. And so the directions are above you for the older ones. The newer ones, the nice thing is the directions are right on the computer screen. You just follow them, you click a button and then follow the instructions. The older ones are above you. And so it'll tell you to do something, and then you click, pull your hand off the mouse, and stand back. Because we're used to, you click a button and boom, there's the screen. That will not happen, especially with the one in 116. That one is dying faster than the other two. And I'm actually torn about this one. This one's really kind of weird. Because that's the one that I've used the most in terms of whenever I worked on an experiment for the lab, that was always the one I was using to take IRs of the product and so forth, and kind of develop a relationship. Okay. And so part of me wants these older IRs to slowly die so I can replace all of them with these nice new ones. But part of me is like, well, I really like this IR. I know exactly how it works. You know, it's kind of like driving your comfortable car, wearing those nice, comfortable shoes, even though there's a hole in them. You don't want to get rid of them because they're really comfortable. So I'm conflicted, okay?
But we don't want to replace them if we don't have to, because it is going to cost us roughly $40,000 for replacing it, which we will do, but if we can squeeze out an extra year or two, that really helps. So when you click the button, stand back. It will eventually get to the next part. When you click that button, stand back, etc. And last but not least is number four, look at the IR. IRs are usually taken towards the end of the lab. They come printed out upside down. And you really want to take a quick look at them and say, hey, does this look right? Because what you don't want to do is, hey, pull that IR out, stuff it in your notebook, assume that it's all good, and then go home, and you're starting to write that report, and then you pull the IR out and look at it, and this is a flat line. Sometimes you get bad data, and you need to know, when you collect the data, is this any good or not? Okay? You may not have time to take another IR, but you know, when I come into the lab next week, I have to take another IR because this one is worthless. Okay? So just look at the IR to determine, is this good? Do I need to take another one or whatever? Okay, time-wise, this lab, not very long. Like I said, the reaction in and of itself, 5 minutes. All right, another 30 to 40 minutes of product workup, and then you do the halide tests. If you have time to do the IR this week, great. If not, you come in, make sure you do it next week, okay? Safety focuses, again, primarily on the hydrochloric acid, so please be careful when handling it. And do we have any questions? Got out in decent time today. So I read a new joke. Never told this one before. And I had to write it down. I don't want to mess it up.
What is the difference between a hippo and a Zippo? One is a little lighter. I never said it'd be funny, folks. All right, you guys have yourself a wonderful day, and we'll see you in the lab tomorrow.